Hello, and welcome to Pet News and Animal Information from the Talking Information Center, Marshfield, Massachusetts. This is Jane Simpson, and today we're starting with readings from the book Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know by Alexandra Horowitz. Yesterday, Pump, my dog, learned, courtesy of a pet supermarket's automatic doors, that when you walk toward walls, they open and let you pass through them. Today, she unlearned it in a spectacularly poignant display. Once a problem is solved, a hidden treat is unearthed. An unjustly closed door is opened, with or without a person's help. The dog is quickly able to apply that same means to solve it again and again. He has identified a state of affairs, fashioned a response, and realized the connection between that problem and that solution. This is both his triumph and at times our misfortune. One success at jumping right onto the kitchen counter to get to the origin of that pleasing cheese odor will be followed by much jumping on counters. If you provide a sitting dog with a biscuit for sitting politely, expect to be inundated by polite sits. With this in mind, it is easy to understand the admonishment that in training a dog, you must reward only those behaviors you desire the dog to repeat endlessly. Such is the dog's mastery of what in psychological circles is termed learning. There is no doubt that dogs can learn. It is the natural workings of any nervous system to adjust its actions over time in response to experience, and of every animal with a nervous system to thereby learn. Under the heading learning comes everything from the associative learning used in animal training to memorization of a Shakespearean monologue to finally understanding quantum mechanics. Dogs' easy mastery of new procedures and concepts presumably stops prior to grasping what a quark is. What they learn is neither academic nor scholastic. Still, most of what we ask that dogs learn can only be described as capricious and arbitrary. Surely any animal recently wild will learn how to get its mouth on food. But typically the things we want dogs to learn, to obey, bear little connection to food. We ask dogs to change posture, to sit, jump up, stand up, lie down, roll over, to act in a very specific way on an object, get my shoes, get off the bed, to start or stop a current action, wait, no, okay, to change mood, cool it, go get 'em, to move toward us or move away from us, come, go away, stay. This may not be quantum mechanics, but it is just as bizarre to these distant moose hunters. Nothing in a wild animal's life prepares him to be asked to maintain the state of holding his rump on the ground, unmoving until released by your cheery, okay. It is notable that dogs can learn these seemingly arbitrary things at all. Puppy see, puppy do. One morning, on awakening, lying on my belly, I pulled my arms up over my head, stretched my legs into pointed toes, and pulled myself up onto my forearms. Aside me, Pump stirred and matched me move for move. She tensed her front legs, stretched them well out in front of her, then straightened her back legs too, pulling herself forward into uprightness. Now we greet each other every morning with parallel wakening stretches. Only one of us swings her tail. Even more interesting than learning commands would be the ability to learn by merely watching others, other dogs, or even people. We know dogs can learn from our instruction, but can dogs learn from our example? It would seem to behoove a social animal like the dog to look to others for information about how best to negotiate the world. In many cases, though, the answer to this question is clearly no. Dogs have plenty of opportunities to see us eating politely at the table, yet they never spontaneously pick up knife and fork and join us. Overhearing us talking is insufficient to get them talking. Their only interest in clothes seems to be chewing them, not donning them. Amply exposed to our activities, dogs don't seem to know how to imitate us. This is not a failing, though it would distinguish them from other members of our own species, consummate imitators that we are. As children and into adulthood, we goggle at each other to see what to wear, what to do, how to act, and how to react. Our culture is built on our keenness in observing others act to learn how to behave ourselves. I need only see you opening a tin can with a can opener once before I can do it myself, one hopes. The stakes are higher than they might first seem. For success at imitation not only gets you the contents of the open can, it is an indication of a complex cognitive ability. True imitation requires that you not merely can see what another is doing, not simply that you see how the means lead to an end, but also that you translate others' actions into your own actions. In that case, dogs are not true imitators, for even after thousands of demonstrations with the can opener, no dog has shown an interest. The opener's functional tone is mute for them. But this is not a fair comparison, you might complain. Dogs simply don't have the thumbs, nor the dexterity they allow, to operate can openers or cutlery. Similarly, they haven't the larynx for speech, nor the need for clothing. And your complaint would be fair. The question is really if the dogs can be taught, by demonstration, how to do something new, not whether they are mini-humans. Watch dogs interact for 10 minutes, and you will see what looks like imitation. One dog flaunts a gloriously large stick. The other finds a stick of his own and flaunts it back. If one dog finds a spot for digging, others will soon join him at the growing hole. One dog's discovery that he can swim leads another dog to self-baptize, suddenly finding himself swimming too. By watching others, dogs learn the special pleasures of mud puddles and of bushwhacking through brush. Pump uttered nary a peep until one of her regular dog companions began barking at squirrels. All at once, Pump too was a squirrel barker. The question then is whether these are cases of true imitation or of something else. The something else that it might be is opaquely called stimulus enhancement. A minor incident involving birds and home-delivered milk in mid-20th century Britain demonstrates this phenomenon best. At the time, doorstep milk delivery was commonplace in Britain, and homogenization was not. Thus, Dawn found foil-capped bottles of separated milk idling unattended on front porches, the cream nearest to the top of the bottles. Up at Dawn with the delivery men is much of Britain's bird population, for Dawn is a propitious time to sing. One bird, the small blue tit, made a discovery. The foil on the bottles was susceptible to being pecked through, revealing a rich, creamy drink just below. A few reports of vandalized milk bottles were lodged. Soon a spate more, then a plague of them. Hundreds of birds had learned the milk bottle trick. Cross with their skimmed milk, the Britons were not long in finding the culprits. For us, the question is not who, but how. How did this discovery spread among the blue tits? Given the rapidity with which it spread, it seemed likely that some birds observed others getting the cream and imitated them doing so. Clever, pudgy little birds. By providing a captive population of chickadees with a similar setup, one group of experimenters observed the phenomenon recur step by step. Their studies suggest a more likely explanation than imitation. Instead of carefully observing and assimilating all that the first cream-pilfering bird was doing, other birds simply saw that he was atop the bottle. This may have attracted them to the bottles. Once landed on the bottle tops, by doing a natural behavior, pecking, they discovered the foil's puncturability themselves. In other words, they were drawn to a stimulus, the bottle, by the first bird's presence. Its presence enhanced the likelihood that they too would become cream stealers, but it did not demonstrate how to do so. This may seem nitpicky, but there is an important difference at work here. In a case of stimulus enhancement, I see that you are acting in some unspecified way on the door after which it opens. If I amble over to the door and kick it, hit it, and otherwise maul it, I might get it to open too. In a case of imitation, I watch exactly what you were doing with the door and reproduce just those actions. The seizing and turning of the knob, the application of pressure after turning, and so on, that lead to the desired outcome. I can do that because I can imagine that what you are doing is somehow related to your goal, your desideratum, to leave the room through the door. The blue tits, on the other hand, need not have been thinking about what the milk bottle tits wanted, and probably were not. More human than bird. Dog researchers wanted to test whether the stick-flaunting dogs are acting more like a blue tit or more like a human being. The first experiment was designed to determine if dogs would imitate humans in a situation in which the people were acting to attain some desired object. The researchers were asking, in essence, whether dogs can understand that a person's actions function as a demonstration that can be followed if the dog is otherwise unsure how to get that desired object himself. They set up a simple experiment in which a toy or a bit of food was placed in the crook of a V-shaped fence. The dog was seated on the outside of the point of the V and was given a chance to try to retrieve the food. He couldn't go straight through or over the fence, but both routes around the fence, around the left stem or the right stem, were equally long, so equally good. When given no demonstration of how to get around the fence, the dogs chose randomly, preferring neither side and eventually making their way to the inside of the V. But when given a chance to watch a person walking around the left side of the fence toward the reward, a person actively talking to the dog along the way, the observing dogs changed their behavior outright. They also chose the left side. It looks as though these dogs were imitating, and what they learned by imitating stuck. When a shortcut through the fence was later introduced, they maintained the route they had learned by watching, ignoring the shortcut. The researchers ran a handful of other trials to be clear what exactly it was that the dogs were doing. They were not simply navigating by smell. Laying down a scent trail on the left arm of the fence did not induce dogs to follow it. Instead, it had something to do with understanding others' actions. Simply watching someone quietly walk around the fence was insufficient to get the dogs to follow the person's route. The person had to be calling the dog's name, grabbing attention, yammering away. Watching another dog who had been trained to retrieve the reward by the left-hand route also prompted observing dogs to go left. This result showed that dogs can see others' behavior as a demonstration of how to get a goal. But we know from experience with our dogs that not every relevant behavior we do is seen as a demonstration. Pump may watch me navigate around strewn chairs, books, and clothes piles as I head to the kitchen, but she will herself charge right through piles to take the quickest route. Other tests are necessary to determine if dogs are truly putting themselves in our shoes and not just prone to follow that human wherever we go. Two experiments have tested just this imitative understanding. The first asked what exactly dogs see in others' behaviors. The means or the end. A good imitator would see both, but would also see if the particular means isn't the most expedient way to the end. From a young age, humans can do just that. They will religiously imitate, sometimes to a fault, but they can also be astute. For instance, in one classic experiment, after watching an adult turn on a light in a usual way with his head, the infant subjects could imitate this novel action if asked to do so. But they did not spontaneously imitate if the adult was grasping something in his hands, making him unable to use them to turn on the light. The infants used their hands reasonably enough. If the adult held nothing in his hands, infants were more likely to turn on the light with their heads too, inferring perhaps that there must be a good reason, besides one hand's being full, for this new maneuver. They seemed to realize that the adult's actions could be imitated, and they selectively imitated them only so far as it seemed necessary to do so. And now, a reading from a book titled The Cats of America by Seamus Mullarkey. Dreaming big. Many of us in America dream of making it big one day. get-rich-quick titles top the bestseller lists, and images of billionaire lifestyles dominate social media feeds. Cherry Pop, the fabulous red Persian, is one feline who turned that dream into a reality. She was the prized pet of Vi and Huey Vanek, millionaires from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. In the late 80s, Cherry Pop flew to shows across the country, completely sweeping championships and taking home the top prizes. Talk about being the cat's meow. When Cherry Pop visited San Francisco, the mayor actually gave her the key to the city. In Los Angeles, she met with such high-profile fans as Doris Day, Betty White, and Angie Dickinson. She was even crowned queen of the city in Boston. Meow! What a glamour puss! Cherry Pop's residence included an aviary and a garden full of squirrels located outside her favorite picture window for her viewing pleasure alone. She dined on choice lean steak, Evian water, and skim milk. That pampered Persian wasn't the only feline to have experienced the high life. In the 1960s, a certain Dr. Greer left his cats, Brownie and Hellcat, over $400,000. What about the meek? It seems that instead it's the furry who will inherit the earth. I am seriously considering buying a cat suit and finding some billionaires to adopt me. Come on, folks, what have I got to lose? The ultimate consumer society. Commerce made America powerful, but it has been advertising that oiled the wheels of commerce, communicating with a mass audience, alerting them to deals and steals, and boosting their desire to try the latest and greatest. This medium of persuasion has played a vital role in American society, and it's only logical that our fine felines would have played their part. If you thought Don Draper of the TV smash Mad Men was the cat's meow of the advertising world, you probably aren't aware of the long history of America's feline persuaders. As early as 1889, cats started showing up in ads across America, like the little black kitty on the bottle of Black Cat whiskey. Now, production of that liquor did end abruptly due to the prohibition of the 1920s. But a black cat would go on to star in several other successful campaigns, such as the catchily named Snappy Snap dresses during World War I. One of the most highly advertised products of the 19th and 20th centuries was tobacco. That is, it was until most U.S. advertising and promotion relating to it was banned. Quite a few brands of cigars and cigarettes had feline links, such as Black Cat Cigarettes. I'm glad that the whole shameful business of cats promoting tobacco was eventually put to rest in the 1980s with several cat-themed commercials from the American Lung Association, urging people not to smoke. In 1933, not long after the construction of their railroad, the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad selected an endearing mascot, a tiny, sleepy kitty named Chessie, whom they promoted on the cover of Fortune magazine with the slogan, "Sleep like a kitten on the C&O. It didn't take long for Chessie to become a national treasure with her own line of clothing, jewelry, calendars, and even pocket knives. I guess not all of us have sharp claws to get ourselves out of tricky situations. Another sensation of the 1930s and 1940s was Snowy, the fluffy white spokescat for Utica and Mohawk cotton mills. She would be featured in magazines such as Women's World as she went out shopping for soft cotton sheets, laundered them, ironed them, and finally used them to make a bed the proper way. One especially lucky ad cat was found at the Humane Society by animal trainer Bob Martwick just before he was scheduled to be euthanized. That orange tabby would later be named Morris and had his debut role as the Nine Lives Cat Food spokeskitty. Morris became the most notable feline in the advertising industry and went on to star in the film Seamus. It stars Burt Reynolds and Diane Cannon. Morris then wrote three books about pet health, care, and adoption, was featured on the covers of Good Mousekeeping and Cat Fancy 30th Anniversary. and stamped his paw print on a bill at the White House. When he happily retired, many other kiddies would audition to play the next Morris. Ah, Morris, that's life as an American success story. Always someone younger and furrier, nipping at your tail, waiting for their shot at the big time. If such stories intrigue you, you might like to track down a copy of The Cat Made Me Buy It. It recounts multiple stories of cats who promoted products and was authored by advertising manager Alice Mooncaster and humane director Helen Yanow. With over 100 colorful illustrations, it's a treat to purchase. Next, playing a key part in our history, Native Americans and their sacred cats. In the 1980s, the remains of a young animal were discovered by archaeologists in a burial ground near the Illinois River, where Native Americans of the Hopewell culture had resided approximately 2,000 years ago. At the time, the remains were labeled as being those of a puppy, as the Hopewell did commonly bury their dogs with them. However, decades later, evolutionary anthropologist Angela Perry opened the box and realized immediately that the find had been misidentified. Her instinct was that it was a cat of some kind. Further study revealed that it was a bobcat, who was only several months old. Amazingly, the bob kitten wore a carefully crafted necklace made of bear teeth and shells. Photographs of the excavation seemed to indicate that the bobcat was intentionally buried with some reverence, as its paws were deliberately placed together. While researchers are unsure whether Native Americans calmly domesticated bobcats or if this was an isolated incident, it's clear that this bob kitten was considered a special animal. Its necklace and careful placement in the burial mound would seem to indicate that it was. Could this be the first pet kitty we know of within what is now the United States? Artifacts show how prevalent wildcats have been in Native American culture, represented as they were in old drawings as well as by headdresses made from wildcat skulls. For instance, warriors would paint their faces with whiskers and claws. After European settlement, when Felis catus, the good old house cat to you and me, was introduced, these domesticated felines found a place for themselves among Native Americans, much as they had already done among Europeans, partly as rodent control, partly as pets. Some interesting photographs from the early days of photography show Comanche people on horseback with cats perched on their shoulders, although whether this was just an anomaly is hard to ascertain. Land ahoy! When Christopher Columbus first sighted the Americas, his first thought was of what part cats would play in the continent's future development. Well, as a cat lover, I'd love to think that was true, but it would just be a big fat old furry fib on my part to make such a claim. However, the first domestic cats here did make land from European ships, where they had been employed as pest control and as companions on those long, wind-tossed journeys. Some were brought on board intentionally, while others snuck onto ships. Whether these stowaways did so in search of overseas adventure or simply in hot pursuit of a plump, tasty rat, without thought of where that pursuit might eventually lead, is unknown to recorded history. We doubt they came in search of cities of gold, although if those legendary places included palaces full of overstuffed velvet cushions, that could have been a persuasive factor. Whether these kiddies who arrived in America yearned for the cozy fires or snug barns of their old countries or immediately took to their new home is a matter open to speculation. Such conjecture might be a suitable topic for an amusing work of fiction. Let me know if you'd like to read such a volume, and I'll see if I could write something worthy of your interest. Mayflower Kitty, the original and the reenactor. Mrs. Haney was a passenger on the Mayflower in 1620. History doesn't grant her the same status as some others. You may never have heard of her, but she played a very important role in the history of American feline history. Her family Bible proudly recorded that her cat gave birth on Plymouth Rock shortly after the ship landed, a fact brought to light by her descendant and cat breeder, Kay McKillen. That historic mama cat must have been quite relieved that those little fur balls arrived safely on dry land. Talk about losing no time and making oneself at home in a new country. Descendants, the descendants of the first founding cat, found useful occupation in their new domain. Interestingly, their pest control duties were not just limited to houses and barns. They patrolled the open fields as well. William Wood's book, New England's Prospect, observes that squirrels plagued the precious corn crop until fed-up farmers released cats among the plants to fight off the pesky varmints. Can't you just see groups of cats chasing squirrels with gusto and doubtless being praised and petted mightily for doing so? In 1955, a replica of the Mayflower was built and sailed from Britain to Plymouth, Massachusetts. Project Mayflower was conceived to commemorate military cooperation between Great Britain and the United States during World War II and to pay homage to the two countries' intertwined heritage. The reenactment was given a special feline touch by a diminutive black-and-white kitten named Felix. Some of the crew had misgivings about bringing this teeny little youngster on the voyage. After all, the boat was a faithful replica of the original and had none of the comforts of a modern vessel. Life aboard would be tough indeed. Well, this intrepid kitty proved them all wrong. Whenever the ship rocked, Felix clung onto the ropes with the grace of an Olympic gymnast. When bunks were soaked from the weather, he always managed to find the driest spot on the ship. The only injury he ever faced was a broken leg from accidentally being stepped on, the curse of a tiny ball of fluff on a ship full of heavy boots. However, his injury mended in record time, and Felix resumed his onboard routine. When the Mayflower replica successfully landed in America, Felix joined the crew in their celebratory parade and even scratched the presiding mayor's hand. You can't take some cats anywhere, can you? Whether to the vet or to a whole new country. Due to quarantine laws, it wasn't practical for Felix to return to England, so he quickly settled into his welcoming Boston home. Despite his voyage to America having been just a facsimile of the original, this kitty found his new life in America to be the real deal, and by all reports, went on to live a long and much indulged life. And that concludes today's reading. Thank you for listening. Stay well and take care of yourself and each other.